Will he or won't he? That was the question coming into the finale of what I think is safe to say the greatest documentary or documentary series that WWE has ever produced. Would this really be the last ride for The Undertaker? I mean, it's in the name of the series. Isn't that what this has been building to? That was the big question coming into the finale. And there's a lot of folks I've seen this week on social media. There's been a lot of wrestling news websites that I've seen running with these great big headlines, breaking news on their Twitter feeds, on their websites. They must have been watching a different episode than I was. Maybe they were watching a different show. This is your Undertaker, The Last Ride review for Chapter 5, Revelation. Just dropped on the WWE Network the other day. The best episode of the series, I thought. I thought it was the best of the bunch, and it was the longest episode as well, clocking in at over an hour. So let's run through this here because, of course, it does build to a big climax at the end. We have this episode picking up after his great showing at Extreme Rules last summer. That was the tag team match, the Graveyard Dogs, Undertaker and Roman Reigns, taking on Drew McIntyre and Shane McMahon. He literally went to Vince McMahon when the match was over and said to him, "I think I'm done. I think I'm done. It's just physically, it's just not there anymore. I didn't want to spring it on you, but I just wanted you to know I'm going to take some time and think about it, but I think I'm done." And that was where his mind was when that match was over. As good of a match as it was for him, he just didn't feel like he had it in him anymore. And here on this episode, we're fast-forwarding 2 months after Extreme Rules, and he visits Madison Square Garden, right? Hallowed ground. Undertaker's had a lot of appearances, a lot of matches over the years in Madison Square Garden. That's been a very important building to WWE. It's kind of, basically their home base has always been MSG. And he gets called upon to make an appearance on SmackDown. That was the night he doesn't wrestle, but he comes out. He cuts a promo. They didn't show it here, but that was the night Sami Zayn came out. Sami Zayn got chokeslammed. And that was the extent to which The Undertaker really did anything that night. But talking about the fact that after 30 years, this could very well be his final appearance here in Madison Square Garden. And just sort of looking around and trying to relish it. And they show him backstage and really for a good length of time, too. We see him in the back kind of reflecting on not just his time at MSG over the years, but his career and the fact that he now finds himself in a position where he feels like he's at peace, where if this is it, he's okay with it, which is what he's been chasing for this entire series. I feel like to the point of nausea. It's like every episode, he's trying to find that closure and he just can't find it. And for the first time here, it seems like he actually is you know, kind of at peace. And one of the things that he focuses on is the fact that the match with Goldberg in Saudi Arabia, which was only a few months before this, really opened his eyes as far as in the blink of an eye, it could just end in a catastrophic way. He came within 2 inches of breaking his neck. And they showed the botched jackhammer by Goldberg from multiple angles, and he tucked his head, but it could have been a complete disaster. And that really made him think hard about, you know, do I really want to be doing this? You know, I got to think about my life 10 years from now. Do I really want to go in there and run the risk of being all, you know, crippled up because I just didn't know when to quit? And that, I think, really opened his eyes. Goldberg inadvertently may have really opened his eyes as far as maybe it's time for me to slow my roll and sort of call it a day here. But, you know, he's okay emotionally and mentally if this is it. And that's the first time we've really heard him admit that here in the series. Now, there were some cool moments here in this scene because you could hear one of the producers off camera say to him, "Hey, okay, do you need anything?" And, you know, kind of begrudgingly on camera, he goes, "Well, I need some, you know, makeup remover." He goes, "I don't know." He goes, "I don't wear makeup. This is my war mask. I don't wear makeup." But then he kind of leads into a cool story about his father. Now, we haven't heard him talk about his father. We know his mother is alive. Apparently, his mother even thinks that Vince McMahon walks funny. And so The Undertaker's mom is still around, but his father passed away a number of years ago. And this is the first time we really have a chance to see a picture of them together and learn a little bit more about him. And he told this cool story about showing up to a show in Houston at the Summit many years ago. Think back maybe in the mid-90s. Took his dad is backstage, and his dad is looking at him as he's in the back getting ready for his match and putting on all of the makeup. And he says his dad looks over at him and just starts shaking his head in disappointment. And Undertaker says, yes, Dad, your 6'8", 330-pound son is putting on eye makeup. And finally, we have an admission of what his actual shoot height is. Right? We've heard 6'9", 6'10 and a half, 7 feet, 6'8". I mean, he might be shorter now after some of the surgeries and stuff, but there it is, Undertaker's height, 6'8". They always said Hulk Hogan was 6'8", which meant Hulk Hogan was probably then, what, 6'5"? Because they always exaggerated when it came to the heights and the weights. I mean, I could believe Undertaker is around 300, but now at least we know what he actually is. But he talked about how he had a full basketball scholarship, and they had photos of him playing basketball, and he was going to have college paid for, and his father couldn't believe it. He says, you're going to leave a full basketball scholarship on the table to go do pro wrestling? And he never really was a big fan of his decision there. But he said his dad was proud of him, and yeah, there was a nice moment here where he said, I miss him, and he's just kind of thinking about him. And this episode dropped, it was the perfect timing because this episode dropped on Father's Day. So to see him get all emotional over his dad, I mean, that was a nice moment. I like getting to know a little bit more about him in that way. You know, we just don't know too much about this guy outside of, you know, what we see in interviews and stuff. And so he opened up a little bit more about that here in this episode. They showed highlights. They showed highlights of his Broken Skull Sessions interview from many months ago, back in November, with Stone Cold Steve Austin, which was the first time, really, you know, under WWE umbrella that he opened up in a major way. We had never seen him giving basically a shoot interview like that before. I mean, outside of the Michael Landsberg thing from 2002, that wasn't WWE, but it was a great interview. He had a lot of great stories to tell if you didn't see it, but it was in the course of doing that interview with Austin that, yeah, they were talking about retirement and coming to the end. And, you know, he acknowledged there's a lot of people, a lot of chatter out there from fans and colleagues and people on social media about what I should do and I should retire and I should just walk away. And again, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that for years now, we've heard Undertaker make the comment that I don't want to be a parody of myself. He even said it back in 02. Like, I don't want to be that guy who overstays his welcome. He, at the time, he was implying that Hogan and people like that kind of fell into that category. And it was like he was deathly afraid of not being one of those guys. And so if you're a fan of his work, or if, you know, you're just a fan of The Undertaker, you know, there were a lot of times over the last 5 years, 6 years, where you look and go, you know what? He's becoming or become what he didn't want to become. This would be a good moment for him to step away. I don't think it was anything malicious. I mean, you do have people that just don't like The Undertaker. I've certainly made a lot of comments on my podcast over the years that I wish he would step away. He made it very clear in that interview that it was nobody's decision but his own, which of course it is. Everybody can have their opinion, but he said, I'm going to make the decision. I don't need other people making the decision for me. When I'm ready to walk away, I'll walk away. And it's in the course of that interview that AJ Styles was watching. And AJ Styles is listening to The Undertaker, and AJ is you know, thinking to himself, and boy, it sounds like this guy might be coming to the end of his rope. He might only have one or two matches left. I want to be one of those opponents. I want to be one of those matches before it's too late. So he says that AJ called him, and AJ said, look, I want to do something with you at WrestleMania, if you're open to it. Now, remember, after Extreme Rules, Undertaker thought, I'm probably done. I don't need to come back. If I don't come back and I end on that note, that's a good note to end on. AJ's telling him, look, you know, I really want to work with you. He is actively politicking. He is lobbying to work with The Undertaker at WrestleMania. And Undertaker is telling him, he goes, look, dude, you know, I'm a big fan of your work. 10 or 15 years ago, you and I would have torn it up, which they would have. But I don't know, man. I don't know. And AJ's like, well, just think about it. You don't have to give me an answer right now, but just think about it. And so that's what got the ball rolling on the whole Undertaker-AJ Styles thing. And AJ talked about, they interviewed him here, and he talked about the fact that he was about the same size as Shawn Michaels was, is. Did Shawn shrink? Maybe he did. I feel like, you know, the older you get, the shorter you get. But he, you know, he compares himself to Shawn size-wise. And Undertaker says he always worked really well with the smaller guys. Now, Undertaker's a giant man, so I would say most of his opponents were probably smaller than him, some more than others. And then when he would be in there with somebody like a giant Gonzalez or a great Khali, usually the results were not great. But he had some good matches with like Kane and Diesel and people that were about his size. Some guys were just so big he couldn't do anything with them. But you know, they showed footage of him working with Shawn. They showed footage of him working with Kurt Angle, Rey Mysterio. They actually showed footage of him working with CM Punk from WrestleMania 29. All great matches. He had legendary matches with Shawn Michaels. He had excellent matches with Kurt Angle. He had good matches on TV, even with Rey Mysterio. I think one was on pay-per-view, one was on TV. They never had a really major program. CM Punk, the match at WrestleMania 29, I thought that was the best match on the show. So he makes a great point, because those guys can bump around for him. You know, he could throw them around, and it helps to have guys like Michaels and Punk, and Michaels and Kurt, who are regarded as, you know, two of the best of all time. I think it would be very hard to go in there with those guys and have a bad match. So he was talking a little bit about that. And Stone Cold is interviewed here. He says AJ right now, for his money, is the best wrestler on 2 feet. Couldn't think of a better opponent to step into the ring with The Undertaker if this was going to be his final match, you know, his final hurrah. His wife, you know, Michelle said the same thing. And Michelle talked about how there was a mutual friend, one of AJ's, I guess, best friends that she and Undertaker had vacationed with for years. They never mentioned who the friend was, if they're in wrestling or if we would know who the person is. But that's how they got to know a little bit more about AJ outside the ring. So clearly, you know, both sides wanted to do it. Undertaker just wasn't 100% sure if he was going to, you know, commit to it. And he just wanted some time to work out physically and make a decision. We got footage of him at the Performance Center, meeting a lot of the, you know, PC people, NXT trainees. Damian Priest is there. Keith Lee is there. That guy Babatunde, however you say his name, he was there. I think the idea here is they wanted him, you know, Matt Bloom asked him to come on in, meet with some of the bigger guys they have down there, and just, you know, teach them, work out with them in the ring a little bit, impart your advice, impart your wisdom on what it's like to work as a big man. You don't find too many of those these days in wrestling. You don't find too many of those these days in WWE. AEW has some big guys. They've got, you know, Luchasaurus and you know, Brian Cage, I guess, is a big guy. Lance Archer. WWE has a few. I guess Corbin kind of would fall into that category. I don't look at him as like a, you know, like a giant. But they got some big dudes there as well. You know, Bobby Lashley, Drew McIntyre, Brock when Brock is around. But, you know, generally speaking, you don't have as many giants. You don't have as many big guys as you used to have. And they've got a few of them down at the PC right now. And so Undertaker is working out with them. Randy Orton, they interview him. He talks about the very first match he ever had with The Undertaker back in 2002 on SmackDown. And they showed Undertaker bumping all over the place for him. He gave him a lot in that match. To the point where they came backstage and, you know, again, Orton was only 22 at the time. And they go to the back and Vince McMahon looks at them. He looks at Mark, right, Undertaker, and says, "What was that? Why'd you give him so much?" And Undertaker said, "Look, you want me to put the kid over, right? You want to see what he's made of? And, you know, down the road, he'll do the honors for me. We'll work together." I mean, he was doing what he felt was right for business. They showed clips of the match from Raw, you know, in the summer of 2002. Undertaker against Jeff Hardy for the Undisputed title in a ladder match on Raw. It's a great match. Not only was it a great match, he gave Jeff Hardy a lot to the point where you thought Jeff Hardy had a shot. You know, he was just fingertips away from becoming the champion. When that match was over, even though Undertaker won, you know, Jeff Hardy came away the big winner that night because he looked competitive in the ring with the champion. You know, and Jeff was still in the early stages of his singles push in WWE. He was really a tag team guy still. I mean, he didn't really catch fire until 2007, 2008 as a singles. I mean, as far as his most popular period, but he looked great. He looked like $1 million. And when the match was over, now remember, Undertaker was a heel. You know, at that time, Undertaker was a heel, and he is looking at Jeff. He's shaking his head. He goes, boy, you gave me the fight of my life. He's paying him respects. He helps him to his feet. You know, he's pointing at, like, he's showing him the ultimate respect. Undertaker put him over huge. That was a huge moment. That was a huge match in the career of Jeff Hardy. And so in Undertaker's mind at that point in time, this is what he was trying to do. You know, he was trying to work with these younger guys and see what they're made of and help get them over a little bit more. So they're at the PC and Undertaker's getting into the ring for the first time since Extreme Rules. It's probably been about 5 or 6 months now. He's running the ropes. He's, you know, trying to get his cardio going. And he's still not 100% sure if he's going to commit to the WrestleMania match with AJ or not. This was his time to kind of figure it out. Can I do it? Is this something I want to move ahead and do? And, you know, he admits, he goes, look, if I do this, it's right back where we've been, right? If I do this and we go out there and we have a stinker, not because of AJ, but because of me, right? He's figuring if this is a bad match or I'm not happy with this match, I'm right back where I was before. Unlike Extreme Rules, which I'm content to walk away, if we go out of WrestleMania and stink out the joint, I'm going to have to come back. I'm going to have to come back and redeem myself, and that whole vicious cycle starts all over again. And he's very much, you know, he's very much cognizant of that. And this was funny, too, because he was joking at this point. He says, you know, this documentary might wind up going on forever. This documentary could go on for 5 or 10 years until The Undertaker is finally content to find that match, to find that moment to go out on. And he's joking, you know, I'll be coming down the aisle with the walker and everything. And yeah, just to see him poking fun at himself was nice. You know, that he gets it. You know, he's not dumb. He's not blind to the realities of physically what he's able to do and what he can't do. You know, and Father Time catches up with you. He's a lot older now, mid-50s. He's not as young as he used to be, you know. But look, I mean, it just mirrors what a lot of people have joked about over the years on social media, podcasts. We're going to see the end of The Undertaker's never going to retire. He's going to be coming down to the ring when he's got an oxygen tank on his back, you know? It's going to look like a rocket pack, but it's going to have some oxygen. He could put the mask on before he gets in the ring because he just keeps coming back year after year after year. You know, he may wrestle forever. That's always been the joke. But he talked about, he really does admire, you could see the admiration, the respect he has for AJ and his work. And, you know, AJ Styles is one of those guys, and you could say it about Sting and other people that have come in very late to WWE. AJ came in 2016, but AJ had this whole body of work before he even came to WWE. And I would hate for him not to have that body of work from New Japan. I'm not taking anything away from TNA. That's really where he made a name for himself. And he had a lot of great matches and impact, but I look at his New Japan run probably as the best run of his career. You just look at purely in-ring and the matches he had with Okada and Tanahashi and Ibushi and Minoru Suzuki, and the stuff that he did during that run is just some of the best work he's done his entire career. I put that above even Impact and his WWE run so far. So it's cool that he was able to land there, kind of make a pit stop there in a way between TNA and WWE. But you look at just the body of work everywhere he has been, and you could just see the respect that Undertaker has, and it makes you wonder, man, if he would have been in this company 10 years earlier when Shawn Michaels was still active, we could have gotten that Shawn Michaels-AJ Styles match, and AJ just against so many people, against so many different people. It's one of those what-if scenarios. But Undertaker, you know, he makes the same joke I made last week. Every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in. And so he says, yeah, I'm going to do it. Of course he's going to do it. Of course he's going to do it. He hadn't even made up his mind in the documentary, and I'm watching it. Even if I didn't have the benefit of knowing that he did come back, I'd be watching this thinking, of course he's coming back. Of course. I would bet everything that he's going to come back. So of course he made up his mind that he was going to come back and he was going to work WrestleMania. And what was funny is AJ and or not AJ, but Undertaker and Vince McMahon played a joke. They played a rib on AJ. And Undertaker told Vince, he goes, look, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to tell AJ that Undertaker's going to work WrestleMania this year, but he's not going to work with you. There's this kid in Tennessee he wants to work with. So, you know, Vince makes the call to AJ, and he picks up pretty quickly, like, this is he's, like, really angry. He goes, this is bullshit. No, that's my match. Like, he's really upset. But, yeah, working with some kid in Tennessee, I think AJ knew at that point that he had been had. So it all kicks off at Sweet Saudi Money. Back in February, Sweet Saudi Money. AJ's in that tournament for the big trophy, the big cup. Out comes The Undertaker. They have a very brief spot where he just gets chokeslammed. Undertaker never took his robe off. His hat never fell off his head. And he just pinned AJ 1-2-3. And that was the kickoff to the story between AJ Styles and The Undertaker. There's a funny scene here before the Saudi appearance where Undertaker is in the back with New Day, and Kofi and Big E are just cracking jokes with him. There's a lot of fun scenes like that in this whole documentary, but even in the special, there's a lot of cool moments like that. So they get into the build-up for the match between them at WrestleMania. Some of the Raw stuff where AJ makes it very personal. And I like that part of the build-up because I felt going into this match this year at WrestleMania, we had to get away from the dead man stuff. When he mentioned Mark Calloway and your wife Michelle, she's going to run you into the ground. She just wants you to keep taking these matches because it makes, you know, a lot of money. That's all she's into. I like that because it was different. And it was going to hopefully open up a side of The Undertaker that we hadn't seen since the Big Evil days, right? 2002, 2003. And Undertaker cut what I thought honestly was... I thought it was, if it wasn't the best promo of his career, I thought it was one of the best. I really do. When he reacted to AJ, he did that pre-tape promo, you know, AJ, or should I call you Alan Jones? And he's talking about, you mentioned my wife and I'm going to make you famous. It was this whole like fusion of Dead Man Undertaker, Big Evil Undertaker, and just plain old Mark Calloway. And he said as much here. He kind of merged the three personalities together. And I thought that was one of the best promos that I have heard The Undertaker cut in his entire career. Was that promo that he cut on AJ Styles. So, as they're, again, building things up for WrestleMania, Undertaker's training, they show him at that gym, that rundown gym down in Texas, and he's got to work out, he's got to get his cardio up, right? He's got to train and everything else. And right at the beginning of his workout, he gets down on the ground, he's like stretching and stuff, and then I look, and they show, and he's got blood pouring out of his nose. I'm like, what the hell? I go, I know the guy is old, but Jesus, I mean, this guy's falling apart here. Just randomly gets a nosebleed, they show this like puddle of blood on the floor. I mean, I think of like Ric Flair. Like he wakes up in the morning and brushes his teeth, and he's got blood pouring down his face. There are just some guys that bleed very easily. But anyway, he had a nosebleed, and Undertaker got some color during his workout. He also got some color during the WrestleMania match on his arm, which we'll get into. But one of the things I loved about this episode, when he's talking about merging the three personalities together, Deadman, American Badass, Big Evil, and Mark Calloway, he talks about having to adapt and having to adjust. That really is one of the things that has kept this guy relevant throughout his entire career. If The Undertaker was still doing the Deadman character he was doing in 1990, or the Purple Gloves in 1994, he couldn't still be doing that straight through until 2020 because that's going to get old. So over the years, we've seen Deadman Undertaker. We saw Batman Undertaker, which he admits was not a good choice for an entrance back at the Survivor Series in 96. He wishes he could take that one back. But I don't know what he was thinking there. Was there a Batman movie that came out around that time? Maybe they were timing it for the release of a new Batman movie in 96. I don't know. But we had Batman, Undertaker. There was Ministry, Undertaker, right? Sacrificing people and speaking in tongues. And then we get to a complete transformation of the Undertaker character. He was out with an injury. This is around the time he was being courted and thinking about WCW, and Kevin Nash was like, listen, I think you can get a lot of money if you want to come down here and join us. And Undertaker was thinking, you know, maybe he was thinking about it, but he just felt that the dead man stuff had run its course. He felt it was stale. And he said, if I'm thinking that it's stale, then what must the fans be thinking? So when he came back at Judgment Day and they showed footage of his return from Judgment Day in 2000, it was the American Badass, and he came out on the motorcycle, and he had the long leather coat and the bandana and the sunglasses and everything, and he just laid waste to the whole McMahon-Helmsley faction. It was the final 30 seconds of the Iron Man match. I love that match. I love that finish. Chaos. I think they were in Louisville that night. Just people losing their minds for the last, like, 45 seconds of that match. It was great. It was great. It made me miss those days just because we don't have anything like... I mean, we literally don't have any audience right now with everything going on. But moments like that, we just don't have a lot of those moments anymore. We just don't. And so that was an epic return. I thought it was great. And he felt that he had to do it. And it was great because now the handcuffs were off. He didn't have to just come out and go... rest in peace. You know, he can actually talk about, you know, though this is my yard and I'm going to beat your ass. And, you know, he would come up with these phrases and these one-liners that just, you know, like he was some big badass, but he could never do that before. You know, before it was creatures of the night. And now if somebody started a what chant while he was talking, he would go, say what if you sleep with your sister? And all the inbred morons in the crowd would go, what? But that's still the best put down of the what chant that I've ever seen. There have been a few good ones, but that's still number one. So they're getting ready for a match at WrestleMania 36, and then the world goes to hell. The world goes to hell. They talk about the COVID pandemic shutting everything down. No more crowds at live events. They're not going to be able to do a match at Raymond James Stadium because they can't do WrestleMania at a stadium. They were going to go to Raymond James Stadium in front of 75,000 people and have a wrestling match. And now, what are we going to do? Now we've got to figure things out. What's plan B going to be? And they were very fortunate that they were one of the matches that had the ability to go off-site so they can tape something, and they can tape something cinematically. You know, Triple H was... you know, it was his idea, I guess, to go the cinematic route with this. But they, I guess the company told, or Vince, or whoever told, you know, these guys and told Triple H it's going to be a Boneyard match. And Triple H's reaction was the same reaction that I had, and probably a lot of you. Triple H is like, what the hell's a Boneyard match? Which, again, I just have to assume they didn't want to go with Graveyard. I don't know, just given everything that was going on, I just think it was some different stupid word for them to come up with. But it was exactly the kind of match we expected it to be. It was a buried alive match. That's what it was. It was a buried alive match taken out of the arena and put into an actual graveyard. And they called it a Boneyard. But Triple H was all of us in that moment. What the hell's a Boneyard match? So they found this 1 acre plot of land about 45 minutes away from the Performance Center down in Florida. And they show it, you know, the drone images from above. It was like a residential area. They had a barn on one end, which they incorporated into the match, if you remember. And they showed us footage of everybody just kind of standing around. They had very little time to convert this thing into a Boneyard, usable for the match. And they did a hell of a job with it. I mean, they really did. And it was interesting to see the transformation of that land into what it turned into. And then things took a little bit of a turn here in this special. We learned something that I don't think anybody knew going into this. Undertaker said they were on their way back, I guess, to the PC. It was him, it was Triple H, it was Michael Hayes. And Undertaker's phone rings, and he can see that it's his niece calling him. And he says, something told him I should probably answer this and not let it go to voicemail. So he answered the call, and she told him that her father, Undertaker's brother, Tim, I guess Undertaker has a whole bunch of siblings, and he has an older brother, or had an older brother named Tim, had a heart attack. Now, this guy's getting ready for a WrestleMania match the next day. Now think about how many times in the course of a year Undertaker wrestles or is traveling. Not very often. And it just so happens that it's WrestleMania season. He agreed to do the match. It's like the one time of year, maybe twice, that he's really on the road for WWE, and he's away from home. He's away from his family. He's in Florida. He's not in Texas. And his brother has a heart attack. And his first question for his niece is, you know, what hospital did they send him to? He's trying to gather all the information. Where is he right now? Where is he staying? And he's saying, you know, his brother lives outside of Austin. And then he corrects himself and he says, lived. He lived outside of Austin. And his niece says, well, Uncle Mark, he's gone. He didn't make it. And so obviously Undertaker gets very emotional talking about it. You don't see this. This is not a man who gets very emotional on camera very often for any reason. And he says, now I've got to call my brothers and tell them the news. I've got to call my mother. And he's thinking, I can just imagine the impact that it's going to have on her having to make that phone call. It's not an easy thing to do. And also not being able to be there. He's not there. He can't be with his mother. He can't be with his family because he's here doing this. And so that made it that much more difficult, and it was a very tough day. So I wasn't aware of the fact that the Undertaker's brother passed away the day before they filmed that Boneyard match. Now imagine, it's a Boneyard match. It's not just a match. So he gets there the next day, and all he sees is all of this imagery of death. Tombstones and coffins and a grave 6 feet, you know, dug up into the ground. And that just makes it harder. You had a family member who just died. They haven't even been buried yet. Now you got to go have a graveyard match. I mean, that's rough. Even for a guy who calls himself the Undertaker, who surrounds himself and shrouds himself in death and all this stuff, that's tough. But he said, the show must go on. I'll never understand that mentality in some of these situations. It goes back even to the Owen stuff, but the show must go on. I don't know if I could have done that. I don't know if I could have done that. I know what's done is done. You know, do what you need to do and then leave. But you know what? It's not always that easy. You lose someone who's close to you. You know, it can't be an easy thing to do. So Triple H called it. It was, he called it a 25-minute fight scene. I'm so happy he called it that. Some people got upset when I called it that on the show. It really wasn't a match. If you think about it, it really wasn't a match. It was a fight scene. That's what it was. It was a 25-minute fight scene between The Undertaker and AJ Styles at WrestleMania. And it was a hell of a fight scene. It was a hell of a fight scene. We had the Good Brothers making a cameo. We had the Druids. I mean, they took us through the whole match. They had they set it to music for Whom the Bell Tolls. They played a video package showing highlights of the entire match from WrestleMania. And The Undertaker says he was really, really happy with how it turned out. He goes, they had a hellacious fight. He was ecstatic with how it turned out. And it was tough because if you remember, during the match, at one point he put his fist and his forearm through the window. There was like a hearse that was parked there. AJ ducked and he put his fist in his forearm and broke the window. Now, I just assume they're filming this like a movie. So it was gimmicked glass and they just, you know, did a couple of takes. Well, gimmicked or not, and I guess it wasn't, but whether it was or it wasn't, he put his fist and his forearm through it and he cut his arm up pretty good, which is a really stupid thing to do because that's the exact same thing Bill Goldberg did when he injured himself in WCW. He had nerve damage in his arm. He was gone for months after that. When you're fucking around with glass, glass is going to win every single time. Glass and fire. Those are two things you do not want to mess around with. And Undertaker has been in Inferno matches. He's messed around with that too. But they're showing they had to pick the pieces of glass, the shards of glass out of his arm. His arm's all bloodied up and all bleeding. So it was a fight scene, but they didn't exactly treat it the way that Hollywood would have treated this fight scene. But he's tough. He's a tough guy. He can take it. So he says it was a long shoot, and it was hard because Undertaker's not a spring chicken anymore. The worst thing that he could do is stand in one place for extended periods of time. Especially when you get the adrenaline going, you're in the middle of a match, and they're like, all right, cut. We're going to take a break here. We're going to, you know, do whatever they need to do. And now he's just standing around. Now the adrenaline is wearing down. He's coming down from that high, and that's when the pain sets in. So they were filming until 5 o'clock in the morning, and I mean, that's a long night of shooting, and a lot of it is just him standing around trying to get loose, trying to keep loose, and so that didn't help matters either. But he was blown away. He was blown away by the feedback to the match, universally positive feedback, even if you didn't think that it was the best match on the WrestleMania card, night one or night two this year. I didn't really hear from anybody who hated the match. I'm not saying those people aren't out there. There's no such thing as a match that literally everybody likes, but I saw the same thing. You know, from my listeners and people on social media, universal praise for the Boneyard match at WrestleMania. How often does that happen? And who would have predicted coming into WrestleMania? Yes, AJ was involved. AJ is great. But that The Undertaker at this stage was going to have a WrestleMania match that was going to be universally praised? Nobody was predicting that going into WrestleMania. The match could not have gone off any better than it did. He was blown away by the feedback. And he said here, it was exactly what he was looking for. How do you top that? How many times during this documentary have we heard from Triple H and Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin and all these people chasing the dragon? Well, he caught the dragon here. Universal praise, rides off into the darkness, a winner. One of the main events of WrestleMania this year. How do you top that? Doesn't get any better than that. It was a complete blessing in disguise. I will forever wonder, what could AJ Styles have gotten out of The Undertaker at this stage of his career in a regular wrestling match? We'll never know. As great as AJ is and Undertaker, we knew Undertaker would be motivated. He didn't want to go in there and have a stinker, but your body can only do so much. I'm sure when he went to wrestle Goldberg, he didn't want to have a stinker. I'm sure when they went to Crown Jewel and he and Kane wrestled Shawn Michaels and Triple H, they didn't want to have a stinker, but they had a stinker. I will forever wonder, what would a regular match have been like? I'll tell you one thing, it probably wouldn't have been as good as this. They got lucky. As awful as this whole situation is that we're all still living with right now, the fact that it happened and these guys were forced to improvise and have a cinematic style match was the best possible thing that could have happened. The best possible thing that could have happened. So we fast forward a couple of months. Undertaker and Michelle, they're at home. They're down by the river. I don't know how many of you remember that skit from SNL. They weren't in a van down by the river, but they're down by the river on their property, just fishing and hanging out. And, you know, basically talking as if This is what he needs in his life. He just needs the quiet and the peace and to be with his family and to go fishing and just be one with nature, nature taker. You know, this is what he has to live for now. This is what it's all about. And they talked about how after the WrestleMania shoot, you know, we talked about Undertaker's brother having passed away. Michelle talked about her nephew, who I think had just graduated from high school. He died in a car accident right after. So that family went through a lot of shit. Undertaker was talking about, he mentioned Kobe Bryant, how impacted he was by Kobe Bryant's death. In fact, there's a part of the documentary, I don't know if it was this episode or the last one, where he's throwing something in the garbage. Might have been this one. And he throws something and he goes, I think he said Kobe, which I guess is a thing that some people do when they shoot something into the trash basket or whatever, and they say Kobe. I guess that's some kind of tribute that people pay to Kobe Bryant. So he obviously was a big fan of the guy and, you know, talked about that having an impact on him as well. And it just made him think of what's important in life. Spending time with family. He's a lot older than Kobe Bryant was, and Kobe Bryant had that taken away from him. And it starts to make you wonder, you know, what am I doing? I've done everything there is to do. There's nothing else. There's nothing left for me to accomplish. He goes, this is what I'm here for now. I have a wife. I have children. I mean, he has multiple children from multiple marriages. I think his oldest child, I think his son is in his late 20s, I think, at this point. Because he's been married, I think, three or four different times. I think three. So he goes, that's really what it's all about right now. It's all about family. You know, and being here, he goes, I have more to contribute outside the ring now than I do inside. Which was a very telling comment. But the Kobe thing, he said, you never know when your number is going to be called. You never know when it's going to be over. And then came the moment that everybody was waiting for. This is the big moment that this whole series has been building to. Is he or isn't he? What is he going to say? What is he going to do when it all comes to an end here? Undertaker talked about, again, having another life now that he has to live and having that ending to his career, if that was to be the ending at WrestleMania with AJ, how perfect that was. And he says he is content if he never wrestles another match again. He is fine with that. But there is a caveat. He does say that if Vince McMahon, if there was ever a time where Vince McMahon needed him, he said, you know, the old in case of emergency, break glass and pull down the Undertaker, that he would have to consider it. He did not close the door on wrestling again if Vince McMahon called upon him and said, hey, Mark, we need you. We need you for a cameo. We need you for a singles match, tag team match. We need you in Saudi. We need you at WrestleMania. Didn't close the door. He said, I'd have to think about it. I would have to think about it. He says at this point, though, he has no desire to get back into the ring. And he gets a little emotional, you know, talking about it and says it's time for the cowboy to really ride off. And he talks about the documentary as being something that really helped him come to that feeling or come to that decision. And listening to all of his peers and what they've said in all these episodes was really eye-opening for him, showed him how much they care about him. I mean, poor Batista in every single episode is talking about the guy like he's on death's door. Like, oh my God, I wish he would stop. I wish he would stop. I wish he would get out of the ring. I wish he would not understand how everybody loves him and admires him. I wish he would stop. So that was very eye-opening for him. And they played a song by George Strait, Troubadour, and they had all these great highlights and clips and rare photos of Undertaker hanging out with people like Crush, Bryan Adams, who passed away many years ago. He was very good friends with him. Yokozuna, somebody else he was very good friends with. Godfather, another great friend of his going back. I think they were in, I guess, the USWA it would have been when he was Soul Taker. I mean, there's a long friendship there between them going back many years. Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, all these great photos they showed. Mick Foley, Triple H, Kane, Edge, just everybody in between. Roman Reigns calls him the godfather of wrestling. Kane calls him the rock that withstood the waves. You know, because there were a lot of tumultuous times in that company over the years, and he was the one rock. He was the one constant who was always there. Through the good times, the really bad times, the booming times, like during the Attitude Era, right on up until today. Right? The waves come in, they wash some of the rocks away, the rocks go here, the rocks go there, and that one just stayed right where it was. And that's the analogy he used. He goes, that was The Undertaker. He goes, that was Mark Calloway. He was always there. He was always a constant. Godfather calls him his brother. Mick Foley says his life would be very different if he and The Undertaker had never crossed paths with one another and had the chance to work together in the Hell in a Cell and everything else. He said his life would be very different. His body would probably feel a lot better than it does. Not too much, a little bit. But yeah, he said his career, his life would be very different. Kurt Angle, they interview him, JBL, Batista, John Cena, they all pay their respects to The Undertaker. And Undertaker says, you know, thank you to all the fans that have been with him, you know, for these 30 years. He's doing all the thank yous. Vince McMahon said that, you know, he made the most out of every opportunity he was given. He says he knows that Mark Calloway can look in the mirror and say, you know, I did good. And he says that the business will always be a part of him, even if he, you know, doesn't actually physically wrestle again. It will always be part of his life. And they play the George Strait song again, and that's what they fade out with. That was the conclusion of the episode. For all of the searching that he has done over these past 3 years, because remember, this documentary, they started filming this in 2017. So it isn't quite the Michael Jordan documentary, which was like 10 parts and just footage that stretches from years and years and years ago to the modern day. But for the last 3 years, they've been filming footage for this documentary. And for all of the searching that he has been doing over the past 3 years, The Undertaker finally here at the end, he finally found his closure. He finally found his closure and his I guess, his inner peace, his inner chi, whatever you want to call it. But to wrap it back around to the point that I made at the beginning of the review when I opened up, I have to point this out. The one word that we never heard The Undertaker use, it's the one word that he did not utter a single time, certainly not here at the end of this episode, was the word retire. He never said anything about being retired or being in retirement. Not once. And again, I see all of these people online and all of these websites, breaking news, The Undertaker retires. The Undertaker has officially retired from the ring. I saw it all week. Everyone's saying that he's retired. All these different headlines. Maybe these people heard something that I didn't hear. Maybe there was some kind of secret hidden scene or deleted scene that they are aware of that I would love to take a look at. Because I never heard The Undertaker utter that word once. What I heard The Undertaker say is that he's content to never wrestle again, but that if he was called upon to come back, which he has been called upon many, many times over the years, to the point where I think Vince McMahon was, he was his biggest enabler, that he would have to consider it. That doesn't sound like retirement to me. That doesn't sound like officially retired. Remember, Undertaker signed a 15-year contract. He confirmed it this week. He had an interview with Sports Illustrated. 15 years. Vince McMahon was not happy about the whole StarCast situation. They didn't speak for a while. Then they came together, and he locked him into a deal that's going to keep The Undertaker legally under contract to WWE until he is almost 70 years old. 70 years old. The Undertaker is not going anywhere. That Undertaker, in that same interview, said that doesn't mean I'm going to be wrestling for the next 15 years, but he's locked in. They have him under contract for the next 15 years, and you can bet that Vince McMahon is going to want him back in the ring at some point. Maybe it's Saudi Arabia, maybe it's WrestleMania, maybe it's something else. But you know that in those 15 years, in the next 3 years, Undertaker is going to get that phone call from Vince McMahon. You just know it. You know that he is. You know that he is. And as he said here, he'll have to consider it. He'll hear him out. I find it, he's talked about Vince as being this kind of like a father figure to him. He seems to have a problem saying no, because he just respects Vince McMahon so much and everything that he's done for him. I think it's very difficult for him to say no. So when he says that if Vince was in a pinch, he would almost look at it as him being disloyal, even though he has nothing left to prove. He owes Vince McMahon nothing. You know, he's made Vince McMahon a lot of money. Vince McMahon has made him a lot of money. He doesn't owe the man anything at this point. He could walk away completely if he wanted to. But I feel like, you know, you listening to him speak and the admiration that he has for Vince McMahon, that he would almost look at it as, how can I leave? He's a friend. He's a brother. He's like a father figure. It'd be like leaving a wounded soldier on the battlefield. If this guy needed me, how could I say no? How could I walk away from him in his time of need? So the next time we have a series of injuries, or the next time that, well, we need a big name, you don't think that Vince McMahon is going to give The Undertaker a call? Come on. Come on. Wise up. Use your head. Of course he is. Of course he is. We've heard this before. He thought that he was done after WrestleMania 33. The whole thing with him leaving the gear in the ring, that was going to be it. But he had a terrible match. And it wasn't until he watched it back many months later, he's sitting in his house watching the match again. He's like grimacing and he's wincing and cringing. And he had to come back because he had to avenge that. He had to erase the memory of that performance by coming back and doing better. But at the time when he did that big finale at WrestleMania 33, that was going to be it. This was going to be like a probably a three-day documentary, not a three-year documentary. He thought he was done then. He thought he was done after Extreme Rules. We saw him on video go to Vince McMahon and literally say, I think I'm done. I think I'm done. Went to Madison Square Garden. Felt the same way. He goes backstage at Madison Square Garden, taking his gear off. And he's like, you know what? I'm at peace. If I never get back in the ring, I'm good. I'm good with it. I finally accept it. Same thing he said at the end of the episode. He said that in September of last year. Until AJ gave him the call. Vince McMahon said to AJ Styles, all right, you want to ask him, go ahead and call him. And that led to what we saw at WrestleMania 36. No one ever truly retires in pro wrestling. If there's one thing I think as fans that we have learned over the years, nobody ever really retires, right? When Cactus Jack was supposed to retire after the matches with Triple H, he didn't. They asked him to come back, in fact, a month later at WrestleMania, and he came back. You know, as a full-time performer, yeah, he was done, but he didn't retire. Terry Funk, I mean, it's a running joke at this point. I think Terry Funk has finally reached the point where he's a lot older, he's not in great health. I think we've probably seen the last of Terry Funk in the ring, but you know what? If he came back, if I read an item online one day in 6 months that said Terry Funk had another retirement match, would I be shocked? Of course not. Because it's become a running joke at this point. You know, Steve Austin is one of the few exceptions to the rule, right? I think Jack Briscoe was back in the day when he was done. But like Steve Austin is one of the only other examples, at least like in terms of big names that I can think of, who really stuck to his guns. And a lot of that had to do with decisions that were out of his hands because it was a medical thing. Maybe he wouldn't have been cleared. I don't know what his doctors told him. Clearly, whatever it was that they said to him, it scared him shitless, and he never came back. You don't think Stone Cold didn't have opportunities to come back over the years to wrestle again? CM Punk, all that stuff years ago. He stuck to his guns, never came back. He is the exception to the rule. But no one ever truly retires in wrestling. I will say this. If the Boneyard match really is the end for The Undertaker inside the ring, if this truly is the big finale for The Undertaker, it is a great, fitting final chapter for him to end on, riding that motorcycle off into the darkness. For, you know, a lot of fans, I think myself included, the best match on either night of WrestleMania this year was the Boneyard match. You can't ask for anything more than that. You really cannot ask for anything more than that, aside from having a stadium full of people. As a performer, I'm sure you always want to perform in front of a live audience. That's about the only thing I think that could have just kind of completed it and made it perfect for this guy. That, however, does not mean that The Undertaker still cannot have a cameo and make some kind of appearance at Survivor Series this year if Survivor Series does in fact go to Texas. If they're able to do Survivor Series in front of a crowd of people, which is what I guess I gather that's what the plan is. If they're able to do that, it's 30 years to the very event. 30 years to the very, I think even the date, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong. I don't have it in front of me. If it's November 22nd, to the day, 30 years to the day that The Undertaker made his debut at the Survivor Series. He belongs on that show. Not in the ring, doesn't have to be in a match, but he belongs on that show. If nothing else, come out, cut a promo, like an actual retirement promo, or give somebody a choke slam, give him a tombstone, whatever it may be. I still feel he's got to be part of that in some. You've come this far. Are you kidding me? All the years that we were wondering, is this going to be it for The Undertaker? Oh, The Undertaker should retire year after year after year. You finally get to year number 30 We're this close away from Survivor Series and you're just going to walk away and do nothing? It'd be like running the football down to the 1 yard line and saying, you know what, I think I'm good. And putting the ball down and walking off the field. You can't do that. You got to at least be there. You got to be part of it in some way. So I hope that he is, and I hope they find some kind of role. Not an in-ring role necessarily, but some kind of role for him on that show. I think, you know, obviously he's going into the Hall of Fame. It's only a matter of when. I think next year is the perfect time. Undertaker is the lead inductee in Los Angeles in the WWE Hall of Fame. So obviously that's coming up at some point soon. He's earned it. He's earned it. Everything that this guy has put his body through and the travel and everything else. And look, the guy's a millionaire. He's got a nice house, got a great family. He's got money in the bank. The guy did well for himself, but he earned it. He earned it. He put the work in. He put the time in. A lot of time away from home, away from family. Again, all the surgeries and everything. He earned it. He earned his place in wrestling. I think back this guy's career when he made his debut at the Survivor Series in 1990, and he was worried at the time he was going to be the one popping out of the giant egg. Thankfully for him, that wasn't the case. I still remember watching that pay-per-view that night, wondering who was in the egg. And then there comes Undertaker coming out. You know, Ted DiBiase does the big introduction from Death Valley. And they show the fans in the crowd, the kids, and they don't know what to make of this. And, you know, just, it's like it was yesterday. Still remember it like it was yesterday. The following year, beating Hulk Hogan to win his first championship, the Gravest Challenge. I have a lot of fond memories of that period. You know, that was right in the middle of my fandom during the Golden Era, you know, where I was growing up with all these guys, Hogan and Savage and Undertaker and DiBiase, Andre and Jake the Snake and Mr. Perfect. It was a time in wrestling that can never be duplicated. It can never be replicated. Larger than life stars. That's what I grew up on. So I have a lot of fond memories from that period. I have a lot of fond memories from his career. But I think back to that debut in 1990. And you look at this guy's career right on through all of the different eras that he was part of. My God. Like, in your mind, you think of these things in eras, right? The golden era, and then here are 3, 4, 5, 6 names that you identify with that period. The new generation era. You have those 4, 5, 6 names you associate with that period. The attitude era. The ruthless aggression era. The PG era. Everyone has their eras that they kind of break things down into. And you think about this guy's career in every single era that he was part of. Every single era that, you know, pretty much, except, you know, take the mid to late 80s out of it, I guess, but that I've been alive for as a fan, the one constant has been The Undertaker. He's the only guy. He's the one. So every era that you could think of, in terms of the longevity that he had, nobody had the kind of longevity that this guy had. You know, from starting out with all the greats, Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, through Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, through Stone Cold and The Rock, through Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, John Cena and Randy Orton, Edge and CM Punk, all the way to Roman Reigns and AJ Styles. Every single one of those eras, The Undertaker wrestled them all. He worked with all of them. He was part of every single one of them. Unbelievable. And nobody else can say that they've done that. Not even Shawn Michaels. And Shawn Michaels came into the company a few years before Undertaker did, only about 2 years. But, you know, he had that 4-year layoff. Then he came back. Then he retired. So that whole period from 2010 to 2020, Undertaker was continuing to work with people. You know, Shawn Michaels, had he stuck around, we would have seen Shawn working with AJ Styles and people like that. But he retired. He left. Undertaker stuck around. Maybe he shouldn't have. We can debate that, but he stuck around. He got to work with all of these people. The stories that he must have to tell. His body of work speaks for itself. The names he's worked with, it can never be duplicated. Now, when I think of his career, if I had to boil it down to my 3 favorite Undertaker matches, and you can submit your own. I'd love to hear from all of you, you know, what your top 3 or your short list of 3 looks like. But I think of, like, all right, what are my 3 favorite, 3 best Undertaker matches? And in no particular order, these are not ranked or anything, but I think of the first Hell in a Cell with Shawn Michaels, which is one of the best matches in company history. I think of the second Hell in a Cell with Mankind, which was something that I have, you know, I think as a fan, it's just one of those things where when you're watching it live, you kind of remember, okay, who you were watching it with, what your reaction was. I mean, it's not like the Kennedy assassination, but just in wrestling lore, I mean, that match is, it's kind of become kind of a legend of its own. And I can remember watching it, and my father was watching it with me. And the moment that he tossed Mick Foley off the top of that cage, I can remember his reaction. I can remember my reaction, thinking, man, this guy's dead. I think we were having pizza or whatever. We just stopped what we were doing. We couldn't believe it. And we couldn't believe the match went on. Took the second bump. While we were watching it, we just felt like this is something that everybody is going to be talking about. It was just a spectacle like nothing I had ever seen before. So I think of that, and I think of WrestleMania 25. So two of the best matches Undertaker ever had in his career, in my opinion, two of the three, were with Shawn Michaels. And I'm not saying that I didn't like the WrestleMania 26 match, but WrestleMania 25 is in a league all on its own. It's the greatest WrestleMania match of all time. And like the first Hell in a Cell, one of the greatest matches in company history, says a lot about those two guys, that they would have two matches like that spread out over the course of over 10 years. My God, I mean, you know, the Hell in a Cell was 97. They didn't have that WrestleMania match until 2009. So imagine having two of the best matches of your career and two of the best matches in the history of the company you work for, and they're same person, and they're spread out over the course of 12 years. That tells you something right there about these two guys as performers. So that's what my top three looks like. One of the greatest of all time, a loyal soldier to the very end. Long may he enjoy his vacation. I call it a vacation. Until he inevitably looks down at his phone one day and he sees that call coming in from Stanford. Here's hoping he lets it go to voicemail. Subscribe, give this video a thumbs up if you enjoyed it. I've enjoyed doing these reviews. I'm glad that you've all been able to join me these last several weeks. This has been fun. I'm sad it's all over, but then I get happy when I realize that I'll be live with you again tomorrow night after AEW Dynamite, 10 p.m. Eastern, right back here on the YouTube channel, as we do each and every week. So I hope that you will join me for that. It'll be a good time. I hope to see you all there. Until then, I want you all to rest in peace.